Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org.
Welcome. Thank you to both of our guests who will introduce in just a moment. I'm Danielle, and I work for the Seattle Public Library. This podcast is part of a year-long project that a team at the Seattle Public Library has undertaken, focused on court-involved and formerly incarcerated patrons. The major project the team embarked on was listening to different people and organizations share about their experiences and work in this field, as well as some of the challenges facing people when they are involved in the court system or released from prison. And along the way, we also heard a lot about the struggles families and communities face as their loved ones are incarcerated. We talked to over 20 organizations and wanted to deepen the conversation between some of our participants and podcasts to share these very important stories and issues with a larger audience. Today, we'll be having a conversation between Deidre Cunningham and Elise Hagley. Thanks as well to the Seattle Public Library Foundation for making this work, as well as the other free programs that the library offers possible. First, I'd like to introduce our speakers. Deidre Cunningham, JD, is currently the Incarcerated Parents Project Attorney at the Washington Defenders Association in Seattle, Washington. She formerly served indigent clients for 15 years as a public defender at the Defenders Association, now a division of the King County Department of Public Defense. Her other legal experience includes representing children and parents in child welfare proceedings, defending indigent adults in Seattle municipal misdemeanor proceedings and in King County Superior Court felony proceedings, and advocating for systemic reforms at the Racial Disparity Project. Deidre is an alumna of the University of Washington School of Law. She currently serves in a volunteer capacity with the WSBA Juvenile Law Section Executive Committee, the King County Bar Association's Juvenile Justice Task Force, and as a board member at Solid Ground, a local anti-racist, anti-poverty, nonprofit advocacy organization. Welcome. Elise Hagley is advocacy lead for Children's Home Society of Washington and works to ensure the child welfare birth parent perspective is incorporated in policy, practice, and system reform efforts. She has former involvement in both the child welfare and criminal justice system and coordinates parent ally work across the state as she is passionate about breaking the cycle for the families coming behind her. She serves on both national, state, and local advisory boards for child welfare system improvement. Thank you so much for being here today. One question to get you started. Can you share what led you to this work or what you see as the greatest challenges for court-involved people, specifically for parents?
Thank you for having me. I think I came to this work really as part of my other professional work with parents that were involved in various court systems and seeing the impact on their families and their children, and working with them to try to keep their families together or bring their families back together as a result, either of just court involvement or actual imprisonment or incarceration. I think what I see as one of the greatest challenges for court-involved people, especially parents, is keeping those connections, maintaining a loving, nurturing relationship with the people that matter most to them, particularly their children, because oftentimes they find themselves in spaces that really don't allow them to do that, that don't allow them to nurture their children, to hold their children, to be available when their kids need them. And so that is a really difficult, I think, difficult experience for the clients I've worked with and for parents that I meet. And so I think part of my work now is trying to help change that reality and try to take away those barriers.
Well, and for me, Elise speaking here, I know what it's like to be that woman incarcerated behind bars, navigating both, facing a significant prison sentence over my head while also having given birth to my daughter and having her removed into foster care at the hospital right at birth. And so having been navigating both dependency and incarceration at the same time, I was terrified, fearful, very traumatized. The lack of coping skills, the lack of of success and making positive decisions in my past life led to just this extreme darkness and just engulfed feeling that things were never going to get better. Fortunately, I mean, for me, my faith really came into board, and when I turned my life over to God, I started really seeing these miracles happening while I was incarcerated, and I was trying to advocate for myself, which is very hard. I mean, so I think when we're dealing with systems and we're dealing with people, the overburden challenges, the under-resourced challenges, maybe the lack of understanding or knowledge of what's going on for that individual at that moment in their life. And so for me, I'm extremely passionate about trying to break that cycle, not only for my own individual family context, but for the families that I know who are sitting, who have made certain decisions in their life. But to their defense, we often have gone through some really significant pain, and how to shape the conversation around, we're not horrible people. There's just these experiences in our past that, you know, things, it's not things that I'm ever proud of, but how do you shape that to the fact to where just removing children from these parents without a lot of support isn't necessarily the answer? We have laws that say otherwise. We have research that says otherwise. So what are we really doing to promote that family unity is what really brought me into this work. Having been a woman who really, by the grace of God, I was able to reunite with my daughter. I had a judge who stopped certain dependency proceedings from moving forward to terminating my rights, who said, wait, isn't she just up the street at the jail? Like, I need to talk to her. I want to talk to her. I had decisions that professionals made in my life that made a dramatic change for the trajectory of my family. And to be able to be where I'm at today, many, many, many years later, seeing the same experiences happening to women and men in our community, in our state, it's just, I'm extremely passionate about trying to move beyond those challenges and to be a voice and saying, hey, wait, like, I'm actually a worthy woman, someone to invest in that should not be written off in this capacity. And beyond that, my daughter, my child, is deserving of being able to be in response with a healthy, whole, you know, healed woman. And what are we doing to promote those connections? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Heavy stuff.
Yeah.
Heavy stuff.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we partner so much in our work, and I'm wondering, you know, beyond, well, maybe we could first tap into some of the challenges that we see right. incarcerated parents face as it relates to their unity with their children.
Right. So there's so many layers. The first layer I would say is just the physical barriers. I think what I come in contact with the most is people struggling just to have the visitation happen when visitation's allowed, and the logistics of having someone in the community support them and bringing their child to see them when they're allowed to have contact visitation. Oftentimes that is a struggle by itself. Who's going to do that? Who will the jail or the prison approve to bring the child? Is the other parent okay with the visit? Is CPS involved? Is CPS going to approve the visit? Is the court, you know, that's involved going to approve the visit? So that is a first layer.
Yeah.
And that's a real barrier. Sometimes there are distances that people have to travel. Children are not even in the same county where their mom or dad is incarcerated. You know, if you come from Whitman County to, you know, say the women's prison, for example, you might need to stay overnight. So you've not only driven like the 5+ hours to get there, then you've got, you know, that costs money. People don't have that money.
Yeah, there's the resources.
There's not hotel vouchers and things of that nature to help people. So what I see is a lot of just logistical barriers.
And then to add to that, the stigma behind incarcerated parents, and then if we throw in the stigma behind a parent who is in child welfare, and
right.
you combine that all into one package,
right.
I just believe, you know, we're dealing with people, and oftentimes there's perceptions we might have of individuals. So I feel like there's a significant need to educate our community and our public that people change, families reunite, and actually research says that when we promote those connections between incarcerated parents and their children. Children growing up in foster care do not experience amazing results, right? I mean, right. We're talking about increased likelihood of criminal justice involvement, juvenile justice, mental health, substance abuse, homelessness, poor educational outcomes. You throw in often those
poor
statistics.
Employment outcomes,
poor employment.
Homelessness.
Those statistics are very parallel also with the statistics behind children of incarcerated parents. So how do we create and leverage resources and support for families to say, rather than coming from a lens of, well, you know what, they put themselves in this situation, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm starting to get more forward about, I didn't grow up and say, like, I want to be a drug addict, you know? And there was experiences in my past from violence and rape and homelessness, I mean, really intense stuff that I've only even recently been able to talk about, right? So we're and the majority of people I know who are incarcerated, who have tried to readjust their life, have tried to, you know, make these positive strides, there's often this pain and this trauma in the past. And I think if we were to open up our ears and open up our hearts to hear from people and to think, like, wow, like, I am so sorry that that was ever a part of your past, but I'm willing to work with you to make sure that you know that the things happening to you today are not a result of those actions, because that's not your worth. So what are we doing to promote to make sure I have this child, right? I'm going to do everything I possibly can to make sure you get a visit with that child.
Right.
Because those children, no matter what anyone says, the majority of them, they want to be with their parents. I didn't see my baby girl for the first almost year of her life, which is not how it's supposed to be in systems. But I will say, you know, we can never get that time back, right? And then you add these layers of trauma. I mean, it took me years to be able to hold a baby, right? And it's not to say, oh, Elise, with your past, like, you know, I'm fully accountable. I mean, I've made horrendous decisions, but I also have worked extremely hard to turn my life around and to not only do that, but to try to break the cycle for people coming behind me.
Right.
And we need to promote that, right?
I agree. And so I agree that, you know, and stigma is a really, it is a huge barrier, because it shows up both in the hearts and in the actions of decision makers, be that social workers, judges, or family members, quite frankly, who should hopefully be seeing that relationship between that child and their parent as the primary reason, the primary thing to support and maintain, but are often in maybe inserting that bias that comes from that stigma into it. And one example I can think of is this this notion that, you know, children really have unconditional love for their parents. They're not thinking about what the crime is or isn't, or why this person is or isn't incarcerated. They just want to see their parents. And I think often the adults around them are making those decisions not with that in mind, right? And inserting their own opinions and judgments about, well, what did this mom or dad do, and why aren't they making different decisions, instead of really focusing on the fact that this child just really wants their mom and dad. And the other piece of that, right, is that children too then internalize what happens, the separation, the not seeing the parent going away, in a way that adults don't. So adults might be blaming the person who they think is making poor choices, but the child's blaming themselves oftentimes. Yeah. Why is my mom or dad not here? I must have done something. They must not love me because they're not here, which is, of course, not at all the case. And so I think we forget to center, we as adults in systems forget to center our behavior and our decisions from the child's perspective. Wow. Like, this child needs their mom and dad. This child's going to blame themselves, because that's what kids do when things aren't right in their world. They start asking, well, what did I do and how do I fix it? And I think we don't do that enough. And then, of course, these issues get exacerbated, and the harm that, you know, I can't imagine suffering the grief or the loss of not knowing where your parent is, and then have adults around you not really being able to wrap around you and give you the support you need, because they're not willing to really own up to their role.
Wow.
In that separation. And so, yeah, so there's, yeah.
it's intense.
This is
you know,
intense.
And then I start thinking about brain science and like yeah. what's actually happening in those beautiful little yeah. brains, and that when we promote
right.
these early connections,
that's
like
right.
that can actually have an impact on their lifelong right. trajectory of positive outcomes, better executive function.
Right.
I mean, all this stuff, the more I'm encountering with it, I'm just like, wow, what are we doing to promote that? That unity.
Yeah. Right.
I couldn't agree more. Right. And I mean, I won't go down the tangent of, you know, system involvement and how hard it is to try to advocate for yourself while you're incarcerated. You might not be getting as many visits from, you know, social workers, other parties to the case, you know, attorney. I mean, there's challenges in and of itself, making sure parents are getting court ordered to be able to go in front of the judge, which was instrumental in my case because I was able to say, hey, guess what? Like, please don't fast track me through the system. I'm actually on my way to treatment. I'm not headed to prison, right? Which was life changing. And so, you know, there's so many additional barriers behind. I was indigent and I didn't have phone numbers of people in my case to call. I didn't know what was going on. I was putting like 60 or 70 kites, which is a way to communicate with the jail while you're incarcerated. I was putting them into the sergeant saying, I just had a baby. I think she's in foster care. Like, I must be having court. Like, I need to get here. And I would never get a response. And so we just need to think that there are individuals who really want to participate. And what are we doing to empower them and to reduce systemic barriers, especially when we know that when we invest in that cause, right, amazing things happen. Because I don't believe SHB 1284 would have been passed if we didn't know these things. So I would love for you to briefly highlight, like, why is that so important? Because it really extends the amount of time before a parent's rights are terminated
right.
while they're incarcerated if they show certain things.
Right. And so the Senate bill that Elise is highlighting, which was called the Incarcerated Parents Bill, was passed actually, it was in 2013, I believe.
Oh, has it been that long?
I know.
Wow.
And the idea was to provide some guidelines for folks who were incarcerated, parents who were incarcerated, their child welfare involved, so they were in some kind of dependency court process with their children. Their children might be placed with family, but might often be placed in foster care if there weren't family that received the child from the court. And so the idea behind it was to sort of slow the process that normally occurs when parents are not physically able to take custody of their children in a dependency case. And when you're incarcerated, there are very few instances where you can have your child with you. And in Washington, there are two instances, but it's a very rare instance. There's a prison nursery program at Purdy, and then there's an opportunity to be on home detention, to be released from prison earlier than normal, placed on home detention, so you're still incarcerated, mm-hmm. And then be parenting in your home
with FOSA,
with the community parenting alternative, and so those are just two instances. And so pretty much in any other scenario in a jail or prison in Washington, you are not parenting your child while you're incarcerated, and so the timelines that have been set out in some of the federal statutes were, I think, designed to speed up the dependency process because when the Adoption and Safe Families Act was passed, there were a lot of children in foster care or children who had not been reunified. Some choices got made at the federal level to create basically a timeline where the court has to say, file a termination of parental rights petition because we feel like too much time has passed. And so when you're incarcerated and then not available in the community to take custody of your child and work on whatever services that the court has asked you to work on, those timelines become a real serious barrier to you ever maintaining your relationship, because then those termination petitions get filed against those parents. And oftentimes, especially if your incarceration is going to last past for a longer period of time than what's now been provided by the court timeline, then your rights usually get terminated because you're not physically available in the community to say, I'm available to take care of my child. And so what the Incarcerated Parents Bill 1284 tried to do was say, if a parent is actually maintaining a meaningful relationship with their child, playing a meaningful role in their child's life, then they can ask the court to find good cause. They can also say because of their incarceration that there's good cause, particularly if there's barriers to them accessing the services or other things that they otherwise would be able to do if they weren't incarcerated. So it really allowed for parents to go to court and say, give me more time because I'm working on it, but I need you to help me with these barriers. I have this relationship with my child. Please keep sending them for visits. This is awesome. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I'm able to reunify, you know, we'll be good. And it just kind of gives this ability for the court to say, yep, that's okay. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise what happens is courts are asked to order the department to file a termination petition if there's not a good cause found. And they're monitored for that, whether they're in compliance with making those findings, which affects the financial funding for the system. And so basically, though, the Incarcerated Parents' Rights Bill really was also trying to get people to focus on engaging the parents while they're incarcerated. So bringing parents to case conferences, talking to them about what it is that they need to do to safely reunify with their children, including them in case planning meetings, like including them in knowing what's happening with their children, what is going on medically, education, well-being, making sure that the contact that's being maintained is really supportive for both the parent and the child, making sure that those visits are happening, and then also making sure that children are living in an environment that's supportive of that relationship, and then making plans if that parent really isn't going to be coming back into the community anytime soon, making plans that are in the child's best interest but also supporting that parent-child relationship. And so it really has these very specific rules where parents are supposed to be present by phone, by video call, are supposed to be engaged by the various professionals, right, and making sure that they're part of the planning and part of the decision making for their children.
It's powerful.
So it's a very powerful thing.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think that that's a step in the right direction. I think we can do some more things. But again, I think we've talked about changing hearts, minds, and attitudes, and then giving people sort of this pathway to say, here's the primary way of seeing progress, or at least giving an opportunity for transformation to happen, is to engage parents and allow them to have some decision-making, some autonomy, some inclusion in their child's life, not shutting them out, not isolating them from the entire process.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting because as you're sharing those things, I mean, throughout my work, I've heard from numerous people, you know, why do we want to help those parents? I think sometimes they don't realize I am one of those parents. Mm-hmm. And, you know, recognizing that in this work, I believe it's really shaping the conversation. Parents are extremely important in this, right? We want to support them. We want to embrace them. But we say we do this work for children, right? So being able to articulate and understand that severing the relationship between a child and their parent for their life is critical. I mean, we hear youth after youth aging out of the system, you know, wanting to be with their, I mean, they're literally aging out of the system and they're running home to their families, right? So what are we doing to help these families heal and make sure we're not, you know, impacting that connection? And I think about the service plans. My hope would be that when an individual comes into, whether it's a jail or a prison, and it can be a safe place for them to say, like, you know, yeah, like I could need some support with, whether it's, you know, chemical dependency, I mean, whatever the gamut is, and whatever that initial assessment looks like, I'm not here to, to try to think that piece through. But essentially, we need to have a platform that enough services are available that it when we're incarcerated, it's not a place where we're just, our time is going. I mean, that is a lot of time you have to be able to work on self, right? I know that programs have made significant differences in people's lives while they have been incarcerated because they started to learn certain things. They started to learn that the things that happened to them as they grew up in the system or when they were, you know, all these horrendous things, it's not to their own fault, and they start to get some healing. I literally just got a phone call a couple of days ago from someone saying, you know, they're getting locked up in jail, and they finally get it, like they need help. It's hard for them to stay clean, and they're asking everywhere they go, I need help, and not getting any answers or any connection to that type of support. So we expect people to come out of jail, to come out of prison and reenter and be a, you know, this healthy whole community, you know, member, but being able to, recognizing I needed some support, you know, I needed people to believe in me. I needed pathways for success. I needed someone to tell me that, you know, you're worthy of a great life. And, you know, I was hand walked into college and what that meant for me, you know, big shout out to the post-prison education program. Love that program, you know, and it's, even though I wasn't personally through it, but I've seen how it's changed, you know, people's lives, and I know education did for me. And so my hope is that I get it, you know, we're dealing, it's under-resourced, but I just believe that when we have an individual exit out of prison and we give them $40 and a bus ticket and the clothes that they came in and we say, don't reoffend, what are you talking about? I'm going to go use drugs, maybe, right? Or I'm going to try, but I'm facing so many obstacles, it almost feels like, what's the point, right? If it's hard for me to find housing, if it's hard for me to find employment, if it's hard for me to just deal with people's facial expressions when they learn my history, I mean, there's a lot of judgment and stigma. And so my hope is that we can create more of these programs and more of these pathways for when an individual who is incarcerated, see, we need our parents who are also navigating foster care to be able to have access to quality services, because in order for me to reunite, I need to say I've completed X, Y, and Z, and I'm making progress in these areas, right? And if I'm behind bars, that's a great amount of time to be working on this stuff. Yeah. And then you take it one step further. How do we make sure that when we're released from jail or we're released from prison, I know where to go? I've already had some wraparound support, and it's none of the issues our community faces I'm trying to blame on prisons and jails. I really want to make that clear. But my hope as an advocate is to say that when we increase these opportunities, when we increase these programs, and when we know that individuals who are ready to change have access to stuff, I mean, that is powerful. That is breaking the cycle, and that is mobilizing a community to say, we believe in you, and we want to do everything we possibly can, you know, for you to succeed. Because I can't tell you how many times I was just up the street, released from jail, pregnant, and I hadn't, where am I going to go? I'm homeless. I didn't know where to go. I didn't know where the supports were. And so I just think that that's an important piece for our community to recognize, for our families, and you know, ways to be able to leverage resources to ensure that people have that access, and especially when we're talking about incarcerated parents, mm-hmm. and the services, maintaining contacts with their children, ensuring that there's quality visitation. Right. I just wanted to voice that piece.
Yeah. And I agree. I think for some folks, the incarceration is isolating them from their community. Like, they may have some support that they're not able to maintain that connection. And then for others, like, it's an opportunity for them to build maybe a healthier network if the network that they came in with, or friends, family, whomever, is not going to help them be successful or be a safe parent in particular. And so those are opportunities. You know, and one would hope, we do have some programs that have been pretty successful at helping people transition out of incarceration, like, you know, like Passage Point at YWCA here in King County. But there needs to be more, obviously, programs really focused on helping people, parents in particular, reunify with their kids.
when they get out.
Yeah. And I, just so you know, I mean, I was a member of Passage Point. I got connected when I was with Department of Corrections. It was before the facility was open. I was one of their offsite clients. And, you know, I was able to get housing through there, learn things like budgeting. What are you talking about, budgeting? You know, I mean, it was like how to set goals and how to. You know, I mean, I was navigating when I was released. I was navigating 50 to 60 hours of services a week, and that was for the DOSA courts, DOC, municipal probation, child protective services. You know, intensive outpatient, everything that goes with it, plus visitation, being on a bus, limited money, surviving off Top Ramen, right? Trying to tell myself my life was going to be different. I mean, we had to think about what the, and no one was talking to anyone, right? Like,
right.
I was taking UAs for 5 different places. No one was sharing that information. So I'm showing up all over the place doing UAs, which isn't always the most comfortable experience. I mean, let's just keep it real, right? So at one point, did we like coordinate around people and provide this wraparound support? And so I needed some, you know, I needed programming to be able to help teach me a couple different things, how to deal with disappointments in a way that was going to be healthy and not the old way I used to manage, you know, the pain. I mean, we're talking about a situation where foster parents are told at birth, like, this is your baby, mom's never going to change, right? Their heart was broken, probably, you know, when my daughter returned to me, and they told me, I have a relationship with them today, that all they heard was horrendous things about me. They were absolutely terrified when my daughter came into my care. And then here I am as the mom, where the first time I laid eyes on her a year after giving birth, she like smiles, holds out her arm, and I'm like, there is nothing that's gonna get in my way about reuniting with this child. And I'm grateful for that perseverance that I had through, you know, people saying, you know, your child should be adopted out. And I'm a huge partner with child welfare. I really consider myself that. And but it's about recognizing, I don't believe that we're going to ever experience positive change for people if we're not willing to point out some of the shortcomings and really put our actions behind our words to say, you know what, we're going to ensure that people of color are not going to be more likely to enter the criminal justice, juvenile justice, child welfare systems. I mean, we have children of color lingering, much greater likelihood of lingering in the system for, you know, years and aging out. I mean, you start looking into the data and you're just like, what is going on here with disproportionality? And so my hope is that we can put some transparency and some understanding behind that, really, in my opinion, the urgency behind supporting our families to be the best that they can be.
Right.
You know?
And creating the access points or those opportunities, again, the opportunities for transformation, right? People need to have the ability to stay in the community and make change before they're in the system, right?
Yeah.
Or at least as the system's encountering them, we could be diverting families into those networks that should be in our community anyway. Right. And again, this is not my job, but again, those things come from trying to influence those decision makers who make policy to maybe take resources that we're spending in other ways, like on incarceration, and putting it into community-based services for the reasons that you just very articulately said. At least I can't repeat any better, because to be perfectly blunt, the systems that we're talking about, having been an attorney in criminal courts context and in dependency courts, they're not designed to fix the things. They're not designed to help people heal, right? I mean, healing is fundamentally necessary to navigate those systems successfully, but the systems are not designed to promote healing.
It's often that punitive piece.
And so we really have to have that community. The community that I'm talking about are the people who want to see everyone succeed. They want to see all boats rising. You know, that's what I'm talking about, because really therapeutic interventions, healing interventions, are what are going to help people make better choices for themselves and their families, help them be safe for themselves and their children, not a court/corrections officer/lawyer/ judge telling them, do these six things and now your life's going to be fine. The systems that we're relying on right now, particularly related to incarceration, are not designed to help folks feel empowered, see their own autonomy, see the power they already have, their gifts, their strengths, and then make good decisions. Like, that's not how that system's designed. And so I just think if we are more honest about that and stop relying on it for those things when that's not what it's there for, and really reinvest in the things we know that do promote healing, I think we will have better outcomes.
And you know what I can't help but think of when you say that is peer-to-peer work, right? What a great time to segue into how critical that piece is, because when someone has been in someone else's shoes that says, you know what, I understand, like, I've been there, you know, but we can use this as an opportunity for growth. You are worthy. You know, if I can do it, you can do it too. Being able to model that change. Why do we have peer mentors and, you know, substance abuse, mental health? I mean, it'd be really interesting. Child welfare, in my opinion, has been, you know, a little slower to really infuse it, but we have some phenomenal work going on across the nation. Actually, in our local community, you know, the Parents to Parents program, I help manage that across Washington State. We also have programs in Arizona, and this connects parents like myself with parents currently involved. And when I was first hired for that work, literally the day after my case was closed, you know, my boss said, I looked at her and I said, you know what, if you hire me, I want you to know my dream is to get this program that we are interfacing with families right at court. I mean, imagine what that hallway feels like. You found out your children have been removed or about to be removed. You're terrified. You're scared. The court paperwork is saying really bad stuff, right? Some of it true, some of it not, but and you know, I'm not really reading a lot of strengths about myself, you know, a lot of good stuff. I mean, it's a scary place. And so you have this interaction at the Parents to Parents program where we are loving on these families and we're helping to embrace their accountability and their empowerment and their knowledge, because when you're in dependency as a parent, it feels like you're in the twilight zone. You could be sitting in court, right, and you're hearing wah, 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 you're a bad parent, not getting your kid back, right? And so we want to make sure that we capture these families and we say, you know what, like, I get it, like, I've been there, but you're worthy of support, and get them connected to that piece. And I had told my boss, so this program, you know, it's my dream to have it be when a parent is incarcerated, you know, and because I remember trying to simultaneously navigate both of those systems. And I'm just, you know, so grateful to this community and to King County Jail, and we were able to get that program in. And, you know, we're seeing success in Spokane as well. We have some of that mentor work going on in Purdy, but we want to see it continue to grow. We want to ensure, especially if you're navigating both systems, that you will have access to, you know, that individual that speaks your language, that's been where you're at and is providing you that strengths-based compassion. Not saying there's not some professional or some really powerful social workers that are doing great stuff and great attorneys. It's not to undermine that work, but there's something about, I can talk to a parent a certain way that no one else can get away with, right? And really calling them on stuff and, like, you know, we're in this together. And so, you know, empowering, again, I just want to really, you know, big thank you to our state legislature. That program was written into state law, and I believe that it's these types of decisions where we're saying, you know what, yes, we want to support our foster parents. Yes, we want to, you know, have certain things, but we also need to ensure that we're doing everything possible to break the cycle for these parents and children, because the law says reunification should be the primary plan in the majority of, not should be, is, right, in the majority of cases. And so we have to make sure that our actions are in alignment with that thinking. And so I just want to really kind of voice that if there are, you know, any parent advocates listening to this podcast, or any individuals in the community who are in support of that work, I just want to say thank you, because I see the difference it makes in the lives of children and families on a daily basis. And it's just an honor to, you know, work alongside so many others who are saying, you know what, we're here for you and we're going to figure this out.
Right. And in along that, Elise, working with the Washington State Parent Ally Committee has really supported me in helping put out the word to all of the parent allies statewide, be they in the Parents for Parents program, which works directly in the child welfare system, or be they parent allies working in other providers
working for sometimes for service providers in the community as peer support to help develop outreach for parents across the state in various incarceration settings. So, and specifically, looking forward to working with them because there was quite a few who wanted to commit to really figuring out how to engage parents who are incarcerated wherever their local parent ally committee was functioning. And so, you know, I have a lot of hope for that because we've seen it work in specifically in the child welfare system. And parents who, even when they're not child welfare involved, need to be able to engage with people because there's that level of isolation that, and you were more articulate about this, Elise, but that level of isolation and just feeling despair. And so I will say I think they're dealers of hope, and I think we have to get them connected with parents who are not not right now always hearing the strengths, the positives that, you know, that you can take those steps forward, that it will result in positive change, that to stay hopeful. And so that's critical, and I'm really excited because I know we've already worked on it together, but we're going to continue working on it, and hopefully have a more, I think, a stronger, more intentional approach statewide for parents wherever they happen to be.
Yeah.
So that's kind of exciting. Yeah. You know, it's unfolding and in progress, but that's pretty exciting.
I know our time is probably coming to a close, but, you know, and what that was making me think of with the Washington State Parent Ally Committee, which I'm able to staff in part of my role at Children's Home Society of Washington, and the importance of individuals that have been formally involved in these systems and elevating their voice in policy and practice. And, you know, in the last 6 years, our voice has helped pass, I believe it's 16 legislative items and budget reform efforts, which is critical, right? I mean, focuses on, you know, disproportionality, child welfare improvements, a whole bunch of stuff, because, you know, when lawmakers and decision makers are coming together and making decisions on behalf of children and families, I'm a firm believer that the consumer voice has to be in that process. When we're on advisory boards, we need to have formerly incarcerated people or formerly involved. The systems we're trying to advocate for and the systems we're trying to improve, those folks need to be at the table, because I believe that it helps think through unintended consequences and really saves a lot of money down the road. It's very hard work to fund, so shameless plug before we close, if anyone is interested in, you know, having a further conversation of how to really mobilize this community and do some phenomenal things in partnering on that work, please reach out, Elise Hagley. I'm more than happy to have a conversation because I see the impact, and I know that you know, we have two women here that are very passionate about trying to move the needle forward, but we as much support as possible in this realm, and to say, you know what, we want to partner and we want to commit on making our community stronger for children and families, I believe is a cause worth investing about.
Thank you so much for an incredible conversation, you two. That was really, really powerful. We really appreciate your time and also appreciate your amazing advocacy work for this community.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.